Good morning, everyone. Talk Radio 930 WTAD. The Mary Griffith Show is underway, brought to you by Refreshment Services Pepsi and Harvest Ridge Coffee. And today's the day we check up on our health with Dr. Brandon Breening from Breening Total Wellness Center, out getting some exercise yesterday, mowing the lawn at the office.
That's right.
Now, I don't understand. Your brother-in-law has a lawn care company, and you've got teenage kids, and yet you're out mowing the lawn.
I'm cheap, Mary.
Even the brother-in-law with a discount isn't going to get your business. Oh, okay. Dr. Brandon Breening, abbreviated visit today because Kyle Moore is waiting in our green room. But let's talk about what's on the top of mind for health these days.
All right. I got two things. You can tell me which one you want to talk about. We can talk about childhood trauma impacting muscle function later in life, or microplastics' journey from the gut to vital organs.
Ooh. I want to talk about both of them. Can't you just do an abbreviated version?
Okay, so
let's talk about child trauma.
Childhood trauma first.
Yeah, right? So this is really very important. What you will remember, the muscle positions you were in when you were being abused, right?
Oftentimes, yeah. I mean, your brain goes back to these things. Your brain always goes back to where we first learned things. You know, you think of the experiment with the little boy and the bunny, right? They showed the little boy the bunny. He was fine. Everything was great. Then they showed the little boy the bunny. They made the loud noise. He starts crying. Then they show him the bunny again, and he cries because he's expecting the loud noise. And they continue this down to where they keep showing him white fuzzy things. And he sees a picture of Santa Claus, and he's just terrified because it reminds him of that bunny. So even situations that don't exactly seem similar will take us back to old situations. But what they found in this study was that, and they asked questions like, did a close family member use drugs or alcohol in a way that caused you worry? Did an adult or parent in your household insult you or put you down? Were you physically abused by a parent? Do you feel loved, important, or special in your family? And were either parents absent for a portion of your life? And they found that a decent percentage of those who answered yes to those questions had less muscle function later in life. Their ATP, which is your energy production, which is what you need to move things, was decreased later in life.
Just because of that childhood trauma.
Well, they can't say for sure, but there's definitely a correlation.
But now that we know there's a correlation, you can't go back and reverse the childhood trauma. So what should somebody who was victimized by a childhood trauma, what should they be doing to keep their ATP production up and to keep their muscle function optimal?
Yeah, well, using your muscles is definitely important because if you don't use it, you lose it. There are certain things that help to feed that energy. Especially we've talked before, ATP production, one of the things that's necessary for that is CoQ10. And CoQ10 gets depleted when we're on certain drugs. So that's another factor in there that people don't think about. So getting these things and having the building blocks that you need with eating well, and if you don't eat well, then supplementing to take care of what you're missing. Even if you do eat well, sometimes supplementing to take care of what you're missing, because you know where we live, it used to be called the goiter belt because there's not iodine in the foods that we locally get around here. We would get goiters because iodine is necessary for the thyroid to function. With the advent of iodized salt, we got better, but people are moving away from iodized salt. And to be fair, the iodine in salt isn't the best iodine you can get anyway, but it's better than nothing.
I mean, first of all, I never salt really from a salt shaker. I mean, I've got enough salt in my food. I don't ever salt from a salt shaker. We use Mrs. Dash. But even salt, now that you go to buy, it's all Dead Sea salt, and it doesn't have iodine added. So is there, like, can you put a drop of it on your tongue? What is iodine? Where can you get it?
Yeah, I mean, well, naturally you can get it if you would like to eat sea fish habit, and also seaweed. But we ain't getting a lot of that around here. So to
pond
get
scum,
it,
I guess, does not count.
Pond scum does not have it. No, because it has to come from the ocean with the salt water there.
Okay.
So yeah. So to get it, you can get it supplementally pretty easily.
Okay.
So
supplement iodine, and remember, if you were a victim of child trauma, make sure that you know that now as an adult, and you keep your muscles active and moving, and you keep them well fed. So they can produce that
and
ATP
find a way
and all that
stuff to deal with,
and also get some therapy.
Absolutely.
If that's necessary. Yeah. Microplastics, man, this is scary as all get out.
Yeah, do you know that the average person ingests 5 grams of microplastics a week?
Now take me into 5 grams.
Yeah, you
want to
know how much
I don't
that
live
weighs,
in England,
right?
Yeah, that's a very small amount, but 5 grams.
Actually, it's about the weight of a credit card.
What?
Yeah.
So I'm eating a credit card of plastic every week?
Every week. You're ingesting it. Now, whether or not how much of that gets into your body,
some of it will pass out
through
our bowel system.
Yeah. They found that the gut does allow plastics through. Now, in surgeries, they will often use plastic because our body's not going to attack it. That's why with... like when they did the pig heart transplant type stuff, they would cover that valve in plastic so that your body didn't attack that and have an immune reaction. But they have found that macrophages, which is your body's voracious eater, it just goes around and eats whatever. You can twist your ankle and increase macrophages. It just loves to eat things. They become more inflammatory when they encounter microplastics. So this goes back to the importance of keeping your gut right and making sure that your gut lining is intact, because the holier, and I don't mean it goes to church 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days a week, the holier that gut is, the more holes it has in it, the more microplastics and other things that get through and cause other trauma. And we've talked about leaky gut many times. Or hyperpermeable gut, if you want to be persnickety about your verbiage on that. But that becomes important because they're actually finding these microplastics in the brain of animals. So we think we have this nice blood-brain barrier, but it's not keeping. And studies have shown, too, that when the blood-brain barrier is shot, or the gut barrier is shot, the blood-brain barrier is probably shot, too. So,
okay.
So
I mean, how can we avoid microplastics, though, quickly? I mean,
you can't.
You can't.
Okay. I mean, even eating clean, they're just all around. They're doing another study to see whether a cleaner diet helps or eating a high-fat diet helps. But time will tell with what those say. So,
well, if they do a study on that high-fat diet, count me
you,
in.
You went in? Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brandon Breening. We will not see you next month.
No, I'll be out of the country next month. So,
and I'll be out of the country with your parents next
month.
But we won't be going to the same place.
No. No.
Okay. Who's going to take care of your kids with your grandparents?
My parents. They'll be back.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They get back from their trip, and then they get 4 grandkids. And really, at this point, my oldest is 18. They can stay home.
That's when you have to watch them
themselves.
Like a hawk. That's when they can't stay home by themselves.
He doesn't even know. I mean, he doesn't leave the house. There's nothing that's going to happen with that kid. He's a good kid.
Well, I'll ask the police chief about that in a moment.
His his sister, on the other hand, now.
Ah, okay. Well, it's always the girls you got to watch out for. 9:28, Kyle Moore next on The Mary Griffith Show. We're back, Talk Radio 930 WTAD. The Executive Director of the Great River Economic Development Foundation is here, Kyle Moore. And Adams County has a new GROW program, and they need applicants. Comprehensive Housing Needs Assessment for Adams County has been conducted, and the study says, gee whiz, we need single-family homes and affordable housing options. probably in multiple family settings. I think this is a broken record. Didn't we say this 4 years ago?
We did. And, you know, the city has various programs, and now the county has come out with a $1 million incentive that offers up to $20,000 forgivable loan per unit developed. And this was just released on Friday, Mary. So if you're a developer in Adams County, this is not neighborhood specific. As long as the property is in Adams County, you're eligible for this. Folks can go on our website, www.gretif.org, and there's a tab on the website where they can request an application. And we're going to have a couple informational meetings. But again, if you are a property developer, or you have properties that maybe it's been too expensive to develop because of the costs have increased, this will be a $20,000 incentive that you can apply for.
This is so fantastic. And again, it is not specific to any neighborhood. This is Adams County program, different than the city program, but basically along the same lines. They want to take areas that are perhaps need great rehabilitation. Maybe there's some new construction that could happen. So $20,000 isn't a lot, but I think anybody would take it. I mean, if I was going to buy a new car and somebody said, well, all you have to do, I'll give you $20,000 to buy a new car, I'd say I'll take it.
You know, I was just on the phone with a developer that has a few lots that he could develop, houses that are about 900 to 1,000 square feet. And, you know, the math just wasn't making sense, but this kind of puts him over that hurdle. And so this is just, you know, there's a lot of properties because of, you know, the prices of things and interest rates and things like that that have just kind of stayed stagnant. And so what we hope this really shakes it up. $1 million is available. We have a committee of seven members of the community looking at it, and so we hope we can get 50 units or more developed in the county, and then that will increase the supply, and then hopefully that will help with the price of real estate in Adams County.
Well, one thing that is for certain, we definitely need the housing, and the real problem becomes, if you're a developer, you're in it to make money. And of course, the best way to make money is to build a kind of a McMansion. The bigger homes, I mean, if somebody can afford a $1 million home, wow, you know, I'd love to put my crew to work on that all summer long and just maybe build that one or two projects and everybody make their living. The problem is, we don't need more $1 million homes. I mean, a few people need them, but the vast majority of us, that 900 to 1,000 square feet. You know, it's so funny. I grew up in that. And nowadays, people are like, oh, how could you possibly? And I think it's just because our expectations have changed, and yet many of our pocketbooks haven't.
That's correct.
People, people are like, well, I'm going to go buy a new house, and they go out to look, and it's like, if you're supposed to pay three times your annual salary for a home, how are you going to afford a $500,000 home?
That's right, especially with interest rates now climbing back up.
Yeah.
You know, it's really made it really not cost effective, especially for younger families that are looking to move out of rentals. And so certainly the nice thing about what Adams County has done is they've said that they're going to invest in multiple types of housing, whether it be apartments, whether it be single family housing, condos, but they're going to try to invest the money to meet the needs of the community. And you'll recall back when we released the study, there's a clear graph in the study that talks about the needs over the next 10 years. And so we'll have two informational meetings, first on April the 23rd at 4 o'clock at the Oakley Lindsay Center. The second will be May 1st on Zoom. You don't have to go to both or even either if you download the application, and it's pretty self-explanatory. But if you have questions on the program, we're going to be there to answer it. And the whole goal is just to get this $1 million invested back into our community. And of course, for the taxpayers, that $1 million is probably going to be returned back three or four times fold, because the builder is going to put a lot more money into the property than just that $20,000. You know,
nobody. Yeah. If you can build a home for $20,000,
exactly.
We wouldn't have a homeless problem.
It's a good rate of return for the taxpayers, and hopefully, then we'll take vacant lots and make them taxable, which of course helps everybody when it comes to property tax times as well.
So this is anywhere in the county, in the city, anywhere in the county.
Correct.
All you have to do is you can come to this informational meeting to kind of learn how to apply.
Correct.
You know, if you're not used to doing that kind of stuff, it always is nice to have a little, you know, refresher course, and this is what we're looking for, because people are going to be judging you. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you're trying to get as much bang for your buck with that $1 million. The great thing about that is, like you said, the $1 million goes out. It doesn't necessarily come back to that same fund, but it is returned to us in property value increase. There are so many vacant lots. There are so many places that could be developed, but developers just don't have the incentive to do it because they can't sell a home for $80,000 that people can afford if it cost them $150,000 to build it.
Correct. You know, we've seen now building prices are about $250 a square foot, which used to be, you know, $100 or $125 a square foot. So if you think about just the cost to build that $1,000 square foot home, you know, now you're talking about a $250,000 home, and most of the time that family of four that could move into that probably is looking at about $140,000 range that they can afford. You know, so it's quite the conundrum we have, and so we hope that this incentive will help reduce the cost to build and put more housing stock on the market. And so, again, people can go to gredif.org. There's a tab on our website that says Grow Program. They can request the application, have the information, and they can always call our office if they have any additional questions.
Okay. So uninhabited, partially uninhabited, vacant lots, buildings that are in desperate need of some kind of rehab and repair. I drive around town and I think, God, we have all this housing crisis. We have so many buildings sitting empty.
Correct.
You know, they're just dilapidated. Mm-hmm. If something could be done to them, they could probably get people in there.
Yes.
Is the idea, you don't really care if it's rental, or would you prefer if it be that they could own it?
It could be owner. It could be where they develop and own it. It could be developed where they sell it. It could be rentals. So it's really, you know, trying to get just more units on the market.
Trying to get that profit margin where that $20,000 makes a difference and somebody gets off the dime and says, okay, now if you're going to give me $20,000, that makes
correct.
It.
And it's $20,000 per unit. And so, you know, for example, if you're building condos or townhomes or apartments, you know, that'll really go a long way if you're building multiple units as well. So, you know, again, the goal, we try to write the program to be as friendly to the developer community as we can. So, for an example, this is a simple, you get the $20,000 incentive based on a certificate of occupancy. So it's not based on the materials you spend or the labor. It's, hey, this building can be occupied. Here's a $20,000. It's a forgivable loan. So that makes it easy on the building community. They don't have to do a lot of paperwork. You know, we try to make it as easy as we could.
Okay. Sounds great. Kyle Moore, director of Gredif. Remember, folks, April 23rd at 4 o'clock in person at the Oakley Lindsay Center. And then if you'd rather do it on Zoom, May 1st at noon. But whatever you do, get yourself educated. If you're a developer out there, or if you're thinking about, you know, rehabbing some properties, this is a great incentive, $20,000 per unit. You have to have your application in by June 18th, so start thinking about it now. Thank you very much, Kyle.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment on the Mary Griffith Show. Our chief of police should be here. We're back, Talk Radio 930 WTAD. The Chief of Police of Quincy, Adam Yates, is my guest today. I got to meet your counterpart, the new guy over in Canton. We were at a fundraising dinner for youth shooting sports the other day.
Good.
He has a big old belt buckle and a big old hat, and he looks like a cowboy.
And a big job ahead of him.
And a big job ahead of him. Every police chief has a big job ahead of them. So we're going to have him on sometime in the future. Very, very nice, personable young man. But let's turn our attention to Adam Yates. First of all, are you judging Unmasking the Singer again this year?
I am.
Okay.
I think it's Friday the 26th.
It is Friday the 26th. I'll be there.
I did have a bit of a scheduling snafu. I'm supposed to be at the Illinois Chiefs Conference. That I didn't realize those dates, so I'm just going to have to leave the Chief Conference a little early and make sure I'm back for that. But I'm planning to be there. I think this will be my third year, and looking forward to it.
Well, let's not let a little thing like the Illinois Police Chiefs Association get in the way of a good night of fun. Recently, there's been some talk in the community. You told me off air you really don't know too much about it, about you know, the process that happens to victims when they come to the hospital and they're a victim of sexual assault, rape, some kind of, you know, violence against them. Obviously, medical doctors have to take evidence. Mm-hmm. They have to treat people and they have to take evidence, and the police department is vitally concerned about the collection of that evidence. Can you just walk us through what normally happens? Because there are specially trained nurses that are supposed to be assigned to these cases. Of course, we're a small community, and if those nurses are all on vacation or off or, you know, sick or whatever, somebody could slip through the cracks, which is tragic for the victim.
Right.
So talk a little bit about what happens if somebody presents themselves either by calling the police or by showing up at the emergency room if they're alleging to be a victim of rape or sexual assault.
Yeah, so it's a quite complicated process, as you can probably imagine. And so in cases when someone reports a sexual assault that has happened recently, of course, there's evidence that we want to try to collect. And there's a process at the hospital, a very in-depth process that takes place. And like you said, most emergency rooms have trained SANE nurses that are specifically, you know, knowledgeable about how to collect evidence, how to make the process as appropriate for the survivor as they possibly can, but to make sure that we collect everything that we possibly can, because you really only have one chance to do that. On top of that, then, you know, Quinata has advocates that come to the hospital that also help facilitate this entire process. So it's very important. Usually our officers, when we respond to a sexual assault, I mean, they're going to take a very minimal amount of information. And so as not to re-victimize the survivor, then they're going to turn that information over to one of our detectives. And then our detectives are going to follow up on the case, and they'll schedule an interview with the survivor, you know, when it's appropriate for them to sit down and have a conversation.
And they may have that advocate with them when
absolutely, yeah.
At the time they're being interviewed.
Yeah, the part that goes on at the hospital with the collection of evidence is very intrusive. It's very difficult, but it's also very important, and so it's vital that you have trained, experienced folks that know how to do that and can get that process done correctly.
So there was this article about how this had been missed once. Is this a common thing to happen? I mean, I imagine it goes off with that. First of all, there are not that many sexual assaults, thank God, or at least not that many reported, which may be another problem. But this seems to be goes along pretty correctly until there is a hitch. And then, of course, that kind of ruins it for that case in a sense, because, like you said, evidence is lost. If you don't collect it within a certain amount of time, it is no longer forensically viable.
Yeah, I can't speak, you know, to the operations at Blessing Hospital, and I'm not specifically familiar with this case. I know that I'm not aware of any issues prior to this where this has been a concern or a problem. You know, what I will say is in the police world, you know, we have a crime scene technician that processes crime scenes. If that crime scene technician is not available, we have detectives that are trained in how to process crime scenes. It's just more efficient for us to have the crime scene tech do it. So just because the crime scene tech isn't there doesn't mean the crime scene is not going to get processed. It's not going to get processed accurately, and the detective is not going to be able to go testify in court to what they did. I don't know if Blessing has a backup plan like that, but it wouldn't surprise me if they did, because I think we all recognize that at times there's going to be gaps in the process, and we're going to have to get things done no matter what.
Well, that brings up another just more broader question about collecting, you know, forensic evidence at scenes of crimes. Sometimes when you arrive somewhere, you're not really aware if it's a crime or, you know, I mean, a body is found.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know if that person died of natural causes. You don't know if they were a victim of a crime. You don't know if they committed suicide. You don't know anything when you first get there, I assume.
Right.
So at what, you know, what triggers a higher level of scrutiny?
Well, I think we always do a preliminary assessment of the scene. And, you know, if you're talking about a death investigation, you know, and some people don't understand, but whether it's a homicide, whether it's a suicide, everything starts off as a death investigation. And it only gets ruled what it is once enough evidence is there to say that. But, you know, you get called to a residence where, you know, say it's an elderly person that maybe had a bunch of medical issues and things like that. I mean, you get a fairly clear picture early on. That still means that we're going to, you know, process a crime scene. We're going to take photos. We're going to collect evidence if there's anything that's amiss. But, you know, a lot of times in what we do in cases like that is we're documenting the scene to show how a crime wasn't committed. So as an example, if the wallet's sitting on the nightstand full of money, and there's a bunch of jewelry that's still there, I mean, it just kind of, okay, this clearly wasn't a robbery, because if it was, they didn't take valuables that a normal, you know, normally would be taken in a case like that. So you do that initial assessment, but you always treat it as though it's going to go the criminal route so that you don't miss anything up front, because you can't always go back and redo things after you've already processed the scene. So, but in most cases, it can be pretty obvious up front whether it was something that was, you know, traumatic, whether it was a homicide or suicide, or whether it was just a death that was related to natural causes.
Moving on to traffic investigations, you know, so often people are in a car accident. Later on, we find out that they were charged with driving under the influence. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that doesn't happen all the time. Some people just get in a car accident because there's a car accident. But how do you process a scene? We just had a crime scene. I don't know if it's a crime, but right here at 4th and Main, where a woman was struck crossing the street by a pedestrian was struck. When you arrive to the scene on something like that, obviously, you know, fire department's there and the ambulance crews are there because they're providing medical attention. Right. The police are there to direct traffic and to keep the situation from escalating. Mm-hmm. But what kind of preliminary things are you doing? Do you talk to the driver to determine if they're impaired? You know, how does that all happen?
Well, it happens a couple of different ways. You know, our priorities when we arrive at a traffic crash is, number one, the safety and the medical treatment for anybody that was injured in the crash. The second priority is to try to clear the crash scene as quickly as possible to avoid another crash that may potentially involve injury. So a lot of people will think that, well, if I get, you know, if I rear end somebody in the middle of Broadway, I need to stay there until the police get there. Well, that's we actually want you to do the opposite. We would rather, if your car is still drivable, pull onto a side street and then call us, because then we're going to avoid causing more issues later on. So many people get injured in secondary accidents that happen because they're sitting in traffic waiting for the police to show up. But, you know, obviously people are going to get treated. You know, we're going to try to get the vehicles moved, but we're always going to make contact with the drivers. And, you know, if there's indications that there's some type of impairment, whether it's slurred speech, whether it's disorientation, you know, you have to be careful that it's not just a medical type of condition that they may be dealing with. But, you know, sometimes it's so obvious because beer cans are falling out of the car and the person reeks of alcohol, and it's pretty cut and dry. In other cases, it may not be so cut and dry, and you'll have the individual go give a blood test or urine test, and then you have to wait for those lab results to come back. And a lot of times, that's what you, when you see that somebody was charged a couple of weeks later, it's because that's the process that was done. Those lab results came back, turned out they had, in that case, more than likely some type of narcotic or something like that in their system, and ultimately is the evidence towards the DUI. So alcohol DUIs are usually pretty obvious up front when it's a whether it's under the influence of some type of prescription medication that they shouldn't be driving, or, you know, some type of illegal narcotic. Usually those lab results will give us that information.
Okay. My guest today is Chief Adam Yates. We're talking about policing efforts in the city of Quincy. Another thing that has been very isolated so far is somebody received some information about the Nazi Party of America. What kind of surveillance does the Quincy Police Department, I know gangs are your biggest problem. Not that I'm saying you're not worried about the Nazi Party, but I mean, that's not something that is usually around here. Talk about general surveillance of groups that are kind of unwelcome in our community. Gangs would be one. People that are affiliated are going to come here and have a big rally or something, which hasn't happened for a while. Right. How does the police department keep on top of this?
Well, we have a partnership with the State Terrorism Information Center over in Springfield that's run by the state police, that partners with the FBI, that we run all of this information through. So when we, like the example you're talking about, you know, we reached out to STIC and asked them to do a workup of the information. We're not aware of any active groups in the city of Quincy. STIC stays on top of, you know, this kind of stuff and assesses this information as it comes in. You know, they kind of sent us information back, said, look, this is, we've not seen, we do see this, it happens regularly, you know, we've not seen more in the state of Illinois than we have in other years. You know, they ask that we continue to provide them information, but it really just is kind of on them to monitor what's going on. They obviously see a lot more of this up in the northern part of the state. That's where the issues are. This was a mailing that came from up in the northern part of the state. There's really no nexus between why it was mailed to who it was mailed, you know, nothing like that. So it's just stuff that we want to keep an eye on. And obviously, if we hear through our folks that we talk to that someone's planning on or started setting up shop in the city of Quincy that's going to be participating in any type of illegal activity, we try to nip that as quickly as we can. If nothing else, to just deter them from doing it in the city of Quincy. You can't always keep people from establishing, you know, criminal enterprises, but as long as we can keep them from doing it in the city of Quincy, I tell people all the time, that's my job. They go over to Hannibal to do it. You know, I mean, that's really, as far as I'm concerned, you know, we got to worry about the city of Quincy. So it really comes down to just keeping your ear to the ground, you know, taking in information and then passing it on to those state and federal partners that are able to gather all this information up and give us accurate information as to what's going on.
Is there a gang problem in Quincy?
Not one that we're aware of. I mean, we've had gang problems in the city of Quincy. But, you know, right now the issue that we're seeing, I don't call it, you know, an organized gang problem, more as groups of teenagers that are causing issues, that are getting themselves into situations that they shouldn't be participating in. But to say that they're affiliated with a particular type of street gang or criminal organization, that's not what we're seeing right now.
So they're not like infiltrating from Chicago and setting up shop down here. These are just our local kids who are getting into mischief, and some of it's more than mischief. But
right.
They don't have a hierarchy that they're answering to Peoria or Chicago or something like that. They're causing this trouble on their own.
Yeah, not that our intelligence is giving us. Yeah, they're causing issues, but nothing that there's any sort of direction or that they're affiliated with any known street gangs that are known to, you know, organize criminal activity.
Because that was a problem years ago.
It was a big
problem.
And
how did you get rid of that?
You basically just, it's very aggressive police work. I mean, you know, our street crimes unit back in the day, you know, you would identify these folks early on, and then you would just keep the pressure on them until they realize that, look, it's easier for me to go back to the city of Chicago or back to St. Louis, where there are more people and fewer cops, and I'm not going to be on the radar, because when you come to Quincy, once we know who you are, it's very difficult for you to operate without us knowing what's going on and or talking to someone that's willing to give information. So it really just comes from constant pressure that this is something we're not going to tolerate in the city of Quincy. And, you know, folks, most of the time, will just end up moving on.
Okay. We'll take a break. We'll come back. My guest today is Adam Yates, the Chief of Police of Quincy.